Well, it's a pleasure to be talking to Dr. David Heine today. And Dave has a long and distinguished career with both WTI, the Williamsport Technical Institute, and the Williamsport Area Community College. Dave was at WTI and WAC from 1963 to 67, and from WAC from 1976 to 1982. He had diverse roles. He was a counselor, he was dean of student services, and he was interim president. Dave, you had early ties with this campus. You graduated from the Williamsport High School in 1958, and so you're familiar with the facilities and what the immediate area looked like. What stands out in your memory about WTI during your high school years?
Well, two things come to mind. One is that those of us across the street in the academic building thought very little of the people who were on this side of the street over in the Technical Institute, that they were the kids who just weren't able to make it. And I found out later that really wasn't true. Some of those were pretty smart kids who got a good education and went on to college. The other thing was that it was the physical appearance of the buildings, not that the high school was so great, but the physical appearance of the building seemed to detract from the campus that we had. Although I was never in the building, but just from the outside, we thought at the time, you know, what's going on over there? It's not that attractive a building. Those two things.
When did you you graduated in 58, and then you completed your additional studies? What did you went to college?
Graduated from Lake Cumming in 1962. Went to the University of Iowa in the fall of that year to study child psychology, actually, child psych welfare research center. But after one semester, didn't like it that well in Iowa. My fiance at the time was back here, so I came back in January at the end of the semester and went to my old college advisor, Dr. Skeith, at Lake Cumming, and said I was looking for a job. And he said, oh, I just had a call from the Technical Institute up there. They're looking for a diagnostic assistant. I said, what the heck is that? He said, well, I'm not sure, but I think they do testing or something. Well, being a psych major, it sounded like a good fit. So I came up. Called and met Dick Paulson, who was the director of counseling, I think his title was, something like that. Anyway, I was a diagnostic assistant, and we worked with rehabilitation students at that time. The Technical Institute, because of the type of programs they had a huge, huge number of students who were physically handicapped, amputees, all kinds of things, visually handicapped. And they came here for a three-week diagnostic program where we would test them in a variety of aptitude tests, psychological tests, try them out for periods of 3 or 4 days in various shops, along with their abilities as they were shown on the test, and then their abilities with whatever their physical handicaps were. And at the end of 3 weeks, then make a recommendation to the rehab counselor who was here. There was a full-time rehab counselor here at the time, as to, yes, we think this person can be a draftsman or a welder or an auto mechanic or whatever it might be. Many of them came here then to school, paid for by the Pennsylvania Bureau of Rehabilitation. They could go to school elsewhere, but at least they had some career focus based on some testing and some actual hands-on experience. And I think that was, I thought it probably unique in the state, maybe one of the few in the country where they actually had those kind of programs.
That was a program, I understand, that was started by Dr. Kenneth Carl. Did he have any interaction with you at that time regarding that?
Not really with the program. Of course, I would see Dr. Carl almost daily. He didn't really have much to do with the program. He was busy doing other things that presidents do, but he was a great supporter of that program and of the rehabilitation program in general, of all the students that were here, because, in fact, they did make up, I can't remember any figures, but they did make up a large percentage of the student body at that time, enough, as I said, that there was a full-time rehabilitation counselor paid for by the state that had an office here in the building.
How did you feel, the fact that here you were working at WTI and you had this negative misperception about the students?
You know, I don't remember at the time thinking anything about it, because once I got here, I saw that it was a pretty exciting, dynamic place in the fact that these kids weren't sitting in a classroom so much as working in drafting tables and down in a welding shop and working on cars. And, you know, it was totally different view that I had at that point than what I had. So I don't remember that I realized it at the time, but it didn't take me long to figure this was a pretty good place.
Any student or experience stand out in the various people you dealt with?
Students?
Someone who came for the diagnostic services and maybe surprised you by showing some real great potential.
It was quite interesting to see sometimes that you would see people with amputees, particularly whether it be a leg or an arm or something, and what they physically could do. I remember an outstanding artist. We had a commercial art program, I'm trying to think what the name of it was now, by Bill Best. But this young man had no arms. And he held a brush in his chin and his shoulder and could make drawings and paintings. He also shot pool that way. And I remember kids taking me to Student Center to see this fellow shoot pool, and a pretty good pool player. So that's an example. But I remember, I don't remember seeing this person, but I remember Dick Paulson telling me that the best block layer they had was a guy with one arm. And I don't know if you've ever lifted 12-inch blocks, but they're pretty heavy. But this guy could throw them and lay them faster with one arm than many people could with two. So it really was an eye-opener to see the kinds of students that we were working with in these programs.
You had talked about the students in rehabilitation services being a significant part of the overall student population. Do you know what the population of students was?
I don't remember, Dan. I would say it was somewhere around 1,000 or perhaps a little less than that. A number of them rehab students, and still a number of veterans, although I think the veterans had gone down by that time. The big influx was right after World War II, but there were still a number of veterans around receiving some sort of assistance from the federal government. But I think the overall enrollment was probably around 1,000 or perhaps a little less, as I recall.
So you were part of student services at that time, is that correct?
I was going to say whatever student services there were, there really was not a department or a division or anything that was called student services. There were some student services, but they were not organized in any kind of a department.
What services were provided?
Well, there was our diagnostic program, which also we were counselors, and we occasionally would have a student referred by a faculty member who they thought needed some counseling of some sort. There was Grant Berry Sr., who was, of course, I don't remember his title, but he was admissions and registrar and financial aid. He did all of those things in his office. And there was a nurse who, I don't know how long the nurse had been here, but because of the type of school it was, there were lots of cuts and bruises and things in eyes and so on that they obviously saw the need to have a health nurse here. And she had a nice office and I think at the time, a well-equipped office to deal with the kinds of injuries that occur on a campus like this. The Student Center came along later, a little bit later, but I don't recall. There were some clubs and organizations that were handled individually by departments. There was no central organizing student activities thing at that time during WTI, but there were some individual clubs through the departments that existed.
Where was your office located?
We were in the old trolley barn, back right smack in the middle of the building. We had an office with three desks in it, and then a pretty large conference room with tables and chairs where we did our testing and counseling and so on. But we were right in the middle of the old trolley car barn. Remember the trolley car rails going down the middle of the hallway? That was my first realization that's what that building was, by the way. I didn't know that what it was when I was over in high school until I saw the tracks.
And health services, where was that located?
That was in the same building around the corner from us. She, as I said, she had a very nice office there and well-equipped. And I don't know why it was there. I guess probably that's where the space was, because it would have made sense to have it over on Susquehanna Street where the shops were. But that's where most of the injuries occurred. But again, it was in the building where there was space, I guess.
You had to take some of these students around, I assume, to the various labs and shops. So what stands out in your memory of what late WTI, what facilities looked like?
Well, they were pretty bad in most cases. When you went over to the shop areas, I don't think there was a pride in what the school was doing by a lot of the instructors at the time. And so it was kind of junky and trashy. When I would walk through the shops and around, I probably didn't think this at the time, but it certainly was now that I think back on it. They did a heck of a job. I mean, there were people that came here from all over the country to interview electricians, machinists, because they weren't trained anywhere as well as they were trained at WTI. And I remember talking to someone at one time who came from Alabama to interview some electrical construction people, because he said, we need to have people that know how to bend conduit. And he said, nobody teaches that. Well, over in the electric shop, there was a huge room which had racks of pipe training people how to bend conduit. And that's the kind of place it was. People were not concerned about how it looked, but that the graduates knew how to bend conduit and knew how to do things in the machine shop, you know, that they came from all over to interview these graduates.
So the WTI's strength was particularly that hands-on practical experience could be applied.
Exactly. And when they changed, and I'm going to interject this point, this is one of the things I thought of earlier when you mentioned it. It became a community college in 1965, I think. And we went to the traditional semesters and 15 credits and all that kind of thing. Well, that changed the way this school had operated for years, because it was based previously on hours. It was 2,000-hour or 2,200-hour program, whatever it was. And they did individual instruction so that as soon as somebody graduated, the next person on the waiting list came in. So almost any time of the year, an employer could come here and find somebody ready to graduate. And they had a program that even if you were close enough to graduate, you could leave and do your last 100 or 200 hours on the job and get credit for it and still get your certificate as a machinist or electrician or whatever. Well, when it went to these semester hours, the instructor said, this is not good, because now we're only going to have people available in May and January and instead of 12 months a year. And there were some employers, I think, at the time who were a little upset about that, because when they needed a diesel mechanic, they needed them now. They didn't want to wait till the end of May to get one. So that was a big change for instructors at the time and for some employers as well, to find out that now they had to wait, now that they had to convert 2,200 hours into credit hours and shop hours. And it was a significant change for a lot of people on the campus to change from the hours and the way people graduated to college thinking and college semesters.
So in 1965, then, this very dramatic transformation, particularly of the structure of teaching, occurred. What do you recall about when you first heard about it, that the WTI was going to become a community college, the Waynesport area community college?
Well, I think there was a lot of excitement, because I think we thought we were going to grow with the way it was set up with school districts. We saw an increase in enrollment, or at least we anticipated there would be an increase in enrollment, and certainly there was, because there would be funding for it now. So I think there was a lot of anticipation that maybe this meant with new, bigger enrollment, better facilities, new buildings, that kind of thing. Once they got through the initial couple years of computers were now in, and so registration was now done with computers, which was a nightmare with class cards and getting not only the existing faculty but the students who were here to change that thinking. So there was a tough time, I think, for students, faculty, and staff to make that change from the thinking of a technical school to a community college. I think it changed the attitude that now we were emphasizing the word community, whereas before we had people from all over the state. Now thinking we'll still have that, but now we're community, so we're going to have all these school districts, we'll have more community people, and maybe it started to change the attitude a little bit in the local community that, hey, this is their college now, and it wasn't something that sat over here on 3rd Street, but it was going to be the community college.
So under WTI, it was essentially sponsored by the Waynesport School District, and now with WAC, it became 20 school districts in a 10-county area. So that was a major transformation.
Absolutely.
Did your responsibilities change?
Yes. Again, I think we're now a college, so we have to start thinking and acting like a college. So we needed to put more emphasis on two things that I recall. One was housing, which was abominable at the time. And number two was student activities. We're going to have more students, and so we need to have more kinds of activities for students to do. So they made a position called, I think it was coordinator of student activities and housing, something like that anyway. And I went from the diagnostic assistant up to that role under Grant Berry now. And started to pay more attention to the housing, which were all of the rooming houses around several block area, which some of them still exist, as a matter of fact, although I think they're in better condition than they were then. Because as we were getting students from sponsoring school districts, I think parents wanted to see what kind of place their kids were going to stay in. And so I started to inspect them and have sort of a, I won't say an approval list, but a list at least that we, that the college had put together and said, you know, here's some places to stay. And then student activities, intramurals, more clubs and organizations, and a very, very active student government we instituted. And I spent a lot of time particularly with student government and student activities area as well as the housing. And also at the time, Grant Berry, who I mentioned earlier, was registrar at admissions, got me to help with registration and set up registration a couple of semesters and so on before, at one point then they hired a registrar as we were growing and getting more complicated.
That was registrar, as I recall, was Dorothy Schultz.
Correct.
You didn't have a background in student activities and student housing, et cetera. So where did you, what did you draw upon?
Well, not in terms of a formal education, but when I was at Lycoming, I was very active in clubs and organizations and fraternity. I was a class president. I was on the student activities board. And I had a mentor there by the name of Jack Buckle, who was the dean of students, that I actually worked in his office. And I think that's where I really got interested in saying, I think this might be a career, student life. And as I was here, I started to pursue taking courses at Bucknell to work on a master's degree, and eventually got a master's degree in counseling from Bucknell. But I think it was my background activities in college and Jack Buckle that said, when I changed from child psych at Iowa to, hey, I think student life might be a career for me.
Did you sometimes call up Jack and ask him for advice?
I did. I did, and I can tell you one, I'll give you one example. You said I didn't have any experience. I did not. We had money allocated to student government, and we wanted to have a concert. And so we had the use, we still shared the high school gym with the high school, was still here at the time. We were going to have this huge concert in the high school gym. My mind tells me that it was Peter, Paul, and Mary. It was a big name for a school like this to have. Well, as student activities director, I was working with student government and so on to set this up. Well, a couple hours before the concert, this guy shows in. I was over at the high school gym, and this guy shows up, turns out to be the agent for these people. Well, we had set it up so that the microphones and so on were down here, and the audience would be up on the bleachers on the side. And this agent says, that won't work. He said, they have to be in front of them, not tiered like that, but they have to be in front of them. So I had to call janitors to come, and we set up several hundred chairs on the gym floor, and I had to have risers. He knew from working with Jack Buckle, we called Jack Buckle, can we borrow your risers? Jack said yes, so we sent a truck out to Lycoming College to get risers, et cetera. And we had quite a time getting that all set up in time, and I remember, I believe it was Bob, He was over in the electronics department, had to come and set up microphones. And one microphone was enough. They needed to have three microphones, and they needed. And it was a learning experience for me to set up a concert. But I'm almost positive it was Peter, Paul, and Mary. Now, there were two men and a woman. And do you remember Hank Moonshine?
Yes.
Well, he was involved with that. He came up afterwards, and he took them out for drinks after the concert, et cetera. And I remember he came to me and wanted to be reimbursed for it. And I said, Hank, I don't have any money. And if I did, I don't think I could reimburse you for alcohol. And he thought it was terrible that we weren't more social with these people that we had here. But that was an example of the kind of learning. It wasn't just for me, but I think the student government and all the students learned what it's like to have a big name entertainment on campus.
So one had to be inventive and deal with stress, obviously.
That's right.
You've talked about Let's go back to student housing.
Mm-hmm.
You talked about going into some of those buildings.
Yes. And I think back what I did, and it's a wonder I wasn't thrown in jail, because I had absolutely no business or no right. They were privately owned houses rented to students, and I would walk through them looking in the rooms and so on. I would meet with the landlords. Many of the landlords knew I was doing this. Some of them didn't know I was doing it. My purpose was to try and clean them up or look for obvious. One of the things I was looking for was alcohol, by the way, in there. But if I saw things to the building itself that I thought were safety factors or something like that. But I weekly would spend time, usually in evenings, walking through these buildings, sometimes in the day, but usually in evenings, and meeting with the landlords about issues that were going on. And they frequently would call me when they were having discipline problems with students. And really, we had no right to discipline those kids. I mean, they were not our houses, not our students. And it was a difficult time when it came to any kind of discipline with them. I mean, the landlord could throw them out if they wanted to, and they'd just go up the street to somebody else who was looking for the money. But housing was not pleasant at that time in terms of, I think, there weren't very many nice ones. There were very few for girls. That was another change, by the way. The college brought in many, many more female students because of the liberal arts program and some other programs that they had. Well, we needed to find more housing for female students. And they're a little fussier than the guys were in terms of what kind of place they would stay in. And that became a challenge to find some. We had some stay down at the Lycoming Hotel, Gennetti now at the time, stayed down there for a while to find housing. But well, that was a challenge for female students to find housing.
You would hear from parents?
Occasionally, yeah, they would say we were over here at such and such and such. I wouldn't let my daughter stay there, and I'd say, well, I probably wouldn't let mine stay there either. But it was a challenge for parents as well to find a place that was acceptable. Sometimes the students weren't quite as fussy, but the parents were usually more fussy, especially with females.
Were you involved at the time in which the college actually contracted out, I think, one or two floors at the Gennetti?
Yes. Yes, I remember that. Mm-hmm. I really had, you know, they, again, it was a private deal between the students and down in the hotel, although the college was involved in it, but I had very little to do with that other than see that the students, if students had any problems or anything with the hotel. I was sort of a liaison, but basically didn't do much.
And some of the female students also stayed at the YWCA? Do you recall?
I think that's true. I think that's true that there were a few that managed to get rooms.
Time, housing there.
That they stayed at the YWCA, yeah, just a few blocks away.
What activities or clubs do you recall? You talked about the student government being very active.
Mm-hmm.
Did you talk about that?
Well, it was new to them, too, to have student government. But I remember the first student government had more females than it had males, which was considering that the females were well the minority at that time. But they were much more interested in doing things in terms of activities and doing things to improve the student life around here, whatever they could, whether it be clubs and dances and activities and so on. And most of the clubs, again, at that point, were still the forestry club under the forestry department or a drafting club or the, I think the business department had a club. You know, they were still pretty much department related, but we again had some money that students, clubs could go for to try and get some money to support their activities, et cetera. So there, I think, began to be more clubs as various departments and other groups of students saw that there were opportunity for funds and opportunity to do things.
Was funding a problem? You hinted at that earlier.
I don't remember it as a problem because I think we started to charge an activities fee, and so there was a pot of money that came to this for student use specifically for that. So I don't remember that it was a great deal of money, but at least it was money, and we had some to start doing some things with.
Well, in this period that we're talking about, 65 to 67, for the earliest years of WAC, the college didn't yet have the high school. So what about facilities for activities?
Well, there weren't many facilities. There was a student center that opened at some point, and I don't remember exactly when, but there was a student center that had some pool tables and ping pong tables and things like that in it. We used the gym for a couple dances, I think. I mentioned a concert that we had there. There really was not other than classrooms for meetings, there really were not much in terms of facilities for activities.
What was gained in shifting from WTI to WAC?
What was gained?
What did students gain?
I think there were a number of gains. One, I think community attitude began to change, as I said earlier, recognizing this is our, you know, we have some say in this now, this is our community. Two, I think the increase in female students in the liberal arts program brought a different kind of student to the school, and I think that was a plus. I think it brought the potential, as I said earlier, too, for growth and the opportunity to do more things as a college rather than a technical institute. And I think there were just, overall, it changed the, after we got through the initial transition, it changed the attitude of a lot of people on campus as well as in the community and said, hey, we are college now. We got an opportunity to do a lot of things here. But the potential of the school districts to increase enrollment, you know, now we had some, there was obviously funding available because they were going to start paying, and there was a capital fee that they were charged so we could do buildings. And I think it was a generally, while there were certainly a host of problems, there was a general attitude in the community and the college that, hey, we're a college now. We're going to do some things.
And one of the primary motivations for the sponsoring district, for many of them at least, was they could send their high school students here. And so there was an increase in the number of high school students using the facilities. Did that cause any conflict from your standpoint in student services with high school and college students?
I never really saw any conflict with that. I think there was a conflict of space because the high school programs were taking up some space that maybe some of the college students or the college programs could use. But there was a big push to transition high school students from the high school program right into the college program. So I think it was seen as a plus to have them here. And if you're a two-year carpentry student, you can go right into the carpentry program and maybe get some credit for your high school work or the auto mechanic program or whatever it was. And so I think it was seen as a plus to have those students here, at least initially anyway. I think that changed later on, but it was a plus at that time.
Well, you talked earlier about the change in structure as maybe something that was lost in going from WTI to WAC. Was there anything else lost? Any programs? What happened, for example, to the diagnostic rehabilitation program?
I don't know what happened to that. It was obviously phased out at some point. I don't know whether the rehab may have been a state that they cut back on rehab funding. I don't remember. I do remember that Paulson was the only counselor at the time. I don't remember that I was replaced at the time. I just don't think that there were any other changes other than the rehab, I think, became fewer in terms of percentage of students.
You talked about, as we talk about students, you talked about a different kind of student coming to WAC, and that offered some opportunities. What did you mean by that, a different kind of student?
Well, not a different kind in terms of, I think, many of them had four-year plans rather than, and this was an opportunity where of low-cost education paid for by the school districts to get their first 2 years and then transfer someplace else. So they came with a different expectation. They came with a college expectation, and versus the people who were here were two-year hands-on experience and go-to-work kind of thing. And as that number gradually increased, I think the academic side began to add more academic classes to the two-year technical programs, and I think that was a plus for those programs to get a little more well-rounded education than what they were getting before, which was strictly they might have a math course and you know, a couple other courses, but basically they just got their hands on. So I think that kind of student, And obviously you're an example of the kind of faculty that came as well, helped broaden the rest of the programs too by having that kind of student here.
Earlier you referred to the Student Activity Center that was located on the corner of Park and 5th Do you have any memories of that place? It's now a bargain shop, and after it was a student activity center, it was an appliance store. What memories do you have of there?
I remember that it was, you know what? Now, Dan, it just hit me. It's up there. Mm-hmm. I was thinking there was a building over here, though, by the machine shop that we had.
Straley building.
Yes.
That was an office. The second floor was office for liberal arts faculty.
No, there was a downstairs. When I was the interim president, when I came back, we had our first faculty meeting in that building over there.
The metal building?
The Lair.
That was down on the other side of the railroad tracks. It would be in the vicinity between where Lejeune Chef is and where the professional development center.
Yes. But wasn't that a student activities center?
Student
center?
But before that, in the early WAC years.
And I remember that now. I completely forgot it until you said it, but it was up there on the corner of 5th and Park Avenue.
Which is about 4 to 5 blocks from campus.
Yeah. But I used to, when I was traveling around at night, I would go up there. We had to hire students to somebody had to be there to be in charge to hand out ping pong paddles and so on. I remember that now. I had forgotten that, Dan. Yes. And I used to, and it was well attended. You'd go up there at night, and there would be, because there was nothing else for these kids to do in these rooming houses. A lot of them didn't have a lot of homework because of their hands-on experiences. So the pool tables and the ping pong tables, I think we had a shuffleboard. There was a TV room. Got a lot of use at night up there, yes. And I used to stop in one or two nights a week as I'm making my rounds in houses just to check on it. But I had to hire students to work up there. Yep, I'd forgotten that. Now I know, yeah.
Yeah. Earlier, you were talking about computerization and scheduling. Mm-hmm. Do you have any memories of that wonderful experience?
Well, it wasn't wonderful at the time because it was new to everybody, and registration the first couple times where students had to go and say, I need this section number in this class, and people were pulling cards and so on.
The punch cards,
the whole thing. And then they had to be run through and lists generated and so on. And the one thing that I do remember is that we were, as I said earlier, sharing the gym with the high school. We were set up for registration in the fall, in September, in the gym. And we had tables, and everybody had the signs for the various departments and where you went, you know, and so on. And we were in the middle of registration, and the football coach came in and said, it was raining out. We need to have football practice in here. You got to get out. And the dean at the time, who was Dr. Jones, who you remember from, was hired from Bucknell, and looked at me and said, what are we going to do? So we quickly moved tables and chairs out into the stairwells and all around and downstairs in the lobby because the football team had priority and they were going to practice because it was raining in the gym and we had to move. Had nothing to do with computerization, but it did have to do with registration and the sharing of facilities.
Well, your supervisor in this early WAC years was Grant Berry Sr. Would you talk about Grant?
Grant was an interesting guy. Grant knew more people than how he knew so many people, I don't know, but he did. But as I said, he was admissions, he was financial aid, and he was the registrar at the time before they hired somebody. Grant was a kind of a calming influence, I think, on everything. Everybody would be upset about all the things going on in the transition and courses changes and this and that. And Grant was, never saw Grant get angry, never saw him raise his voice. He just had a good sense of humor, and he just kept things rolling along and kept me rolling along, and had this little tiny office, which was about half the size of this studio that we're in, and he had room for 2 chairs for parents, or maybe 3 chairs, parents and a student to come and sit down. That was it, but he was quite a guy, and I think during that transition period, he probably had more influence in making that work than a lot of people realized at the time. He was a good guy.
So his people skills was particularly one of his many strengths, as you said, in calming the staff and students and so forth. Another person, of course, you worked with was the last president of WTI and the person who created WAC, and that is Dr. Kenneth Carl. Would you talk about working with Kenny?
Kenny was a dynamic individual who loved this place probably as much or more than Dr. Parks did, who was one of the founders, but dynamic, always in a hurry, willing to go anywhere and talk about this place, willing to spend time with the school district, school people. I think he was while he liked the students and the programs, didn't spend as much time down with faculty and students, perhaps, as he might have. But he was so busy doing other things, doing presidential-type things at the time with college. And I think because the colleges were so new in Pennsylvania, and we were, I think, the second one, and so there was a lot of things going on in Harrisburg. There was a coordinator of community colleges appointed in the Department of Education, and Kenny met with him and was in Harrisburg a lot. But just dynamic, and I think he probably had a vision that he saw what the community college could do for this place, and that maybe it had reached its limits as a technical institute, and with the community college movement, was smart enough to get us in on the ground floor, and a great tribute to him that we did.
Now, he had assumed, as did everyone else, that there would be a great growth in population almost immediately. Student population, that is. Why do you think that didn't occur?
I don't know. It probably takes a while for the image of WTI, technical two-year hands-on kind of place, to thinking of it as a college, and that we do have liberal arts, and we had English comp and higher math and, you know, history courses and all those other things there now. And maybe we didn't have the marketing or admissions staff to be spending time out in the school districts and other places to really market it. We sort of relied, I think, on some of the high school kids that were still coming here in the program. So there's probably a lot of things that we could have done better at the time if we would have done a little more planning and thinking about marketing and really working on trying to increase admissions. But I just don't remember that. Again, as I said, it was Grant Berry, and eventually later, we hired a director of admissions. Bob Hans was the director of admissions, and he started to make trips to schools and so on. But it took us a few years to get all that going and to get, I really think, get the image changed that we were your local college, and this is where you need to come and for a good low-cost education and get that message out.
So that going and visiting schools for recruitment for admissions, that was something new then that emerged?
Yes. It never had to do that before. Never had to do that. It was lived on its name, WTI. I mean, as I said, people all over the country knew Williamsport Technical Institute. You know, you couldn't find aircraft mechanics or electricians or machinists anywhere that you could find here.
And that focus on hands-on learning, that remained as they shifted into the Williamsport Area Community College?
Yeah, I think it became somewhat less because they started to require these programs to take more academic courses, and so they had less time for hands-on and had to spend more time in the classroom. And I don't think that was necessarily a bad thing. I never heard people say, well, they weren't as well-trained or they weren't as good at diesel mechanics or auto mechanics as they were before, but it certainly changed the ratio of hours on hands and classroom to add those academic programs.
Well, you left in 1967 and took a position at the University of Delaware and then at the Delaware County Community College. Then came back in 1976. What did you learn from those experiences that you brought back to WAC?
What did I learn? Well, I started a doctoral program, so I learned a lot about things that weren't too helpful in terms of work. I also went to the University of Delaware as assistant director of residence in charge of residence halls. I had 7 men and women residence halls at the time. So I picked up a couple of years' experiences about residence halls and students in residence halls and housing. Then when I went to the community college, I was a counselor, director of counseling. I was director of admissions for a year. I got a lot more experience in terms of student life student activities in terms of advisor to clubs, a couple clubs down there. I started to teach some courses, so I became on the faculty side, sort of an academic person in a way. I was teaching some courses, psych courses. And when this position in 1976 came open, it was assistant dean of students. Assistant dean of student life, I think it was, actually. Anyway, Grant Berry had called me, and having worked for him before, and told me the position was open, and so my wife and I, we really loved Delaware, and our 2 children were born down there, and she said, well, why don't you apply and see what happens? Well, I applied and was interviewed and offered the job. And so I said to my wife, we have to decide. We want to move back to Williamsport. Well, my parents and her parents both were here, and so there were some reasons to come back, and so we did. And came back as assistant dean, reporting to Dr. Waters, Ed Waters, who was, I think, academic dean or
academic
vice president,
dean.
Academic dean, and reported to him at that time.
A lot of society had changed very significant ways in that period from 67 to 76. What were some of the societal shifts that you think was affecting education in general, higher ed in general, and including here at what was WAC?
Well, of course, the Vietnam War, that was the prime thing that was going on at the time, and there were some racial unrest that was going on at the time throughout the country. I think colleges became a focus for a lot of things at that time. I don't remember that the community colleges, at least this community college, was caught up in that, although there were probably some veterans who were coming back from the service who were here. There were certainly more female students here, and I think began to show some more interest in female activities and courses and things like that. But the 9 years I was gone was from 67 to 76 was certainly a lot of unrest in our country, and a lot of that ended up with students on college campuses who continued to show unrest on college campuses as well. How much it affected here, I don't recall when I came back that there were any major change, other than there was a much larger student body and a lot more female students around. And at that point, the college had taken over the high school building, and so that expanded significantly in terms of space and programs. And so the college is much larger when I came back, with a lot more female students and a lot more of the academic faculty as well.
So there were some new programs that had come into existence in the time that you were away or had expanded. Let's talk about some of those. What about financial aid?
Well, yeah, there were a whole lot of things that had to develop that out of necessity. Financial aid is a good example, and Grant Berry Jr. was the director of financial aid when I came back and had a couple of people under him. That's how large it was. I mean, you're talking now millions of dollars in financial aid. Government programs had expanded. Counseling had now started. There was a career counseling center, which had I think at the time it had two, and we eventually had four or five career counselors in that. Some of them funded by grants. The state was very big in grants for all kinds of those type programs, particularly for community colleges. And the college here was able to get a lot of funds to fund career activities. And women's programs, there were some more activities and interest in women's things as well. Student government was still big at the time. There were more clubs and organizations, and intramural athletics, and as well as some varsity athletics that also started to develop. It just was a college campus, you know.
So the varsity athletics had not existed under WTI?
No.
Had they started it when you were first here?
I can't remember when. I want to say yes, that the first year or two we were here, we did start to get, it seems to me, wrestling and basketball maybe, but I'm not sure of that, but it seems to me we did kind of start that because there were Penn State two-year campuses and some others, though there were only a couple of community colleges at the time. But eventually the community college had its own league as they got up to six or seven colleges here in the eastern half of the state and had its own varsity athletic league for a number of sports.
Were you involved in that as the assistant dean? In effect, actually, you were the dean, but you didn't have that title?
Right,
services.
Right. Okay. Not really, not a whole lot. Tom Vargo was hired then as director of athletics, and because we were interested in students together, we did work together, but I didn't have anything to do with that. But I did one thing when I got involved in the athletic. When I was at Delaware County Community College, I was a tennis coach for 2 years of the tennis team, and so I got involved in understanding that the varsity athletics was becoming a big thing in the community colleges.
Why do you think that was important? Or was it important?
Well, I guess you could say, why does Penn State or Michigan State or any other school, like Cumming, any other school, have athletic programs? And I think because they're costly. Why do they do that? Well, because it attracts students. And I think it's like any students should go where they want to go because of the academic program that has what they want and it's a good school and all that. But let's face it, that's not realistic. Students go where they can play basketball or wrestle or play football or whatever. Women's field hockey, women's soccer, all those things. And I think the colleges, community colleges, got caught up in that, and that became part of life. You know, we have basketball, and so they started to recruit local kids to come play basketball or wrestle or whatever.
You feel that that did have that effect at WAC at that time? It did recruit students?
I would think it did, because we started to have the programs, and they were certainly here, so I would think those that...
What about attendance at those events?
Well, that's another story. I don't think attendance was very good at any of them. Certainly didn't attract many of the other student body to come and see them. A few of their friends or roommates, maybe, and maybe a few local parents, but attendance was not big at any of those things, no.
One of the services that had come into existence was Tot Watch, child care.
Oh, yes.
Had that started before you came, or did you?
I think that started when I came back in 76. I think we started that. There was, being a community college, so there were a lot of older students, housewives and men, lots of folks who were older who had children. And so we started that daycare center in one of the rooms in the first floor of the old high school building. And I don't remember any numbers at the time, but obviously that was enough to make it successful. And there was a charge for that. It wasn't a free service. But again, community colleges attract a variety of students, and older students is one of them. And so there were people who had young children who needed a daycare.
So that was a societal shift from your WTI early WAC?
Yeah, that certainly was a societal shift, becoming a community college. And I think all community colleges the same way. When I was at Delaware, I was in charge of the daycare center there, and it was a much larger daycare center. And there were lots and lots of young, particularly mothers of children who were going to school and who wanted a daycare for 2 or 3 hours a day while they were taking classes. That was, I think, a function more of the community college than anything in society, perhaps. But
intramural athletics, which you mentioned, were you responsible for that, or did Tom Vargo run that?
Tom Vargo had that. I had very little to do with that. But again, that was when you've got several hundred men and women, you need to have something for them to do. And so intramural athletics became, again, an important part of the college atmosphere.
Did that have support? You know, a spectator sport for probably didn't, but do you know whether intramurals did?
I think somewhat, because I think it was more competitive. I mean, when you have an intramural volleyball and you've got 6 or 8 or 10 teams and they're all kids that know each other, et cetera, there's a lot more spirit involved in going to see the intramural volleyball match than perhaps the college basketball game.
A major change in academic services and student services was the development of developmental studies. You were involved with that. Would you talk about that?
Yeah. That was an interesting challenge for me to come here and find that I was going to have an academic program, because other than teaching some classes, I was really not. I was in student life. And the fact that I first met Veronica Music was a real interesting thing. Veronica is quite a person, as you know. But that program and the people who were involved with it, Pete DeManis and Jim Logue and Diane Coons, just a marvelous, marvelous group of people who were really sincerely interested in helping students who needed to improve their skills, whether it be math, reading, writing, et cetera. And I think through some funding, we were able to get some equipment. We were able to have some space, although not the best space, up in Rishel, and it was obviously moved different places. But that was a great, great program, and I was really happy to be part of that and have some really great people in it. I think we had some students, being community college that was open admission, who needed to improve their skills before they were able to tackle some of the more rigorous academic courses. And when you looked at some of the numbers there at the time, it obviously was needed greatly.
You made reference to Rishel. That was a factory building on the west of the campus,
yes,
on 3rd Street, and where the library was at the time, computer center, and classrooms. So mm-hmm. That's where developmental studies maybe started. Did you get involved in doing any travel as a result of developmental studies because of some grant programs?
Yes, I did. I mine is not telling me what I'd like to know, which is what the name of the program was. But a statewide, actually not a statewide, a national program that we, Act 101 was part of it, and there were some other funds that were available. But I did do some traveling and some presenting at several. I remember Columbia, South Carolina was one place I went with some folks, put on a program down there for some community college people, and some other statewide places where we went to do some programs based on the, what we were doing.
Did you yourself do grant writing to get funding for some of these programs? Or would staff be doing that?
I think the staff did it. I probably had a little hand in it, but when you have people like Veronica, I'd let Veronica handle that as far as that. And I think the Career Center, Larry Emery, who I hired at the time as director of the center in career counseling, wrote a couple of excellent grants. So I probably had a finger in it, but I was not mainly responsible for writing grants.
Were there any other student services that came into existence either while you were away or that you brought into existence when you returned in 76, after 76?
Probably were, but I can't remember any. The career counseling is one that I remember, and starting the counseling activities there was a big one. We remember we got a grant and bought a van to travel around, do career counseling at the schools.
Did you travel on that yourself?
I drove that van. It was a 26-foot van to the Hughesville Fair and the Clinton County Fair, and spent some time trying to recruit students out of that van. Yes, with Chet Schumann and out of admissions. Yes, I drove the van a few times.
And was it successful?
That's a good question. My experience when I would be at the Hughesville Fair, for example, would be that the people that stopped to pick up brochures or ask questions already knew or already had somebody here or were already attending or something, and were not really, you know, somebody brand new looking to get information about the college. So whether it had an effect, I don't know. But I know for several years, pre-Bruder years, that it went to Hughesville and Bloomsburg and Clinton County, and that it was staffed all the time there. And as Chet Schumann would say when it was down at Bloomsburg, small enough to stand in the palm of your hand. We're always right next to this little tiny miniature horse thing. I can't think of the horse's name, but it was small enough to stand in the palm of your hand. Chet Schumann's famous saying.
You have been coordinator of student housing. And what was housing like now in this period after your return?
Well, we hired a housing coordinator, finally. It became large enough at some point where the college said, you know, we need to come up with some funds, and we need to have a housing coordinator. And I advertised and interviewed and hired a young man, Charlie. I can't think of his last name now, but Charlie was the first housing coordinator. And he was 100% devoted to inspecting, providing lists, meeting with parents and students who had questions about housing. And I think I used him a little bit at that student center that we talked about. I think I also had him out there sometimes. But finally, I think as it grew, people recognized that housing needed to be have some more attention devoted to it. And so funding was found to have a housing coordinator.
Had anything changed in maybe formalizing the relationship with landlords?
Yeah, the student government, actually, we started to have a council, and we would meet periodically with landlords and students to talk about issues and things. And I think the landlords themselves realized that they needed to do a little more, that while there was certainly money to be made, they needed to put some of that money back into their facilities if they wanted to attract the students, because if they didn't, they would go somewhere else. And so I think the housing started to improve somewhat in terms of the facilities themselves and making them better.
Were there any absentee landlords or slum landlords?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. There were still absentee landlords and slum landlords around who somehow the students seemed to find those who wanted them. Most students did not. But those students who were happy and didn't care but figured that they could get away with damage or they could get away with drinking or whatever. Drinking, by the way, is alcohol is an age-old college problem. and will always be as young people are growing up from going away from home for the first time and having their first opportunity to drink alcohol. And I wouldn't say a major problem, but certainly I started to get more involved with discipline and trying to educate people on the dangers of drinking as underage and so on. And I remember a number of incidents where we had to involve parents and others that, you know, you're 18-year-old out here drunk and we need to do something. But when they're in a house unsupervised, you know, there's no way to control that, really.
In the spring of 1980, Dr. William Federson, who was president from about 73 to 1980, announced his acceptance as president of the Napa Community College in California. You were named interim president. How did that come about?
Well, we went to a board meeting, and as at all board meetings, the deans were always expected to be in attendance at board meetings. And as I walked into the room, Dr. Bone from Lock Haven, who was married, he said, come with me. He said, I left my coat down at the Ross Club. He said, I need to go get it. Ride along with me. I said, sure. So I got in the car, and we were going down, and he said, we just had a meeting down here, and he said, we've decided that we would like to ask you to be the interim president. And I about fell out of the car seat. I said, what? Yes. He said, we talked about it, and we talked about it with Federson, and he said, we would like you to be the interim president while we have a search. And I said, Dr. Bone, I don't know what to say. I said, except that I'd like to talk to Dr. Federson before I say yes. And I think when we got back to the meeting, I think they all looked at him and were expecting a nod or something, and I hadn't agreed to it yet. So the next morning, I went right over to Dr. Federson, and I said, Bill, I said, you know, I'm shocked. I said, I would think in the interim you would want maybe your academic person or your financial person. Why the dean of students? And because, by the way, I had been promoted to dean of students in the interim there. And his answer was, and I think this reflects back on what kind of person Bill Federson was, who was a thinker, and I think just didn't jump into things. He said, I made a list of the qualifications that I thought an interim president should have. And by the way, he said, I made it interim, meaning you are the president. He said, sometimes people take acting as, well, you know, you're just filling the space for a while. But he said, interim means you are the president in this interim period. And he said, that was my recommendation to the board, and they agreed with it. But he said, I made a list of the qualifications that I think the interim president should have. Maybe not the same list of qualifications as the permanent president, but for the interim president, this is what I think it should be. And he said, when I looked at all of the deans, he said, you had fit the bill. You had the qualifications. And he said, I went through this with the board, and he said, they agreed. And I said, well, if that's the case, then I don't see how I can say no. So that was in, I think, early June or the end of May, and he was leaving on June 10th or June 12th or something like that, and I became the interim president.
And immediately inherited a list of challenges.
Oh, unbelievable. Let me see. The chairman of the board, Bill Shrum, was out with heart surgery and, you know, not available. The contract with the faculty was expiring, or maybe had expired or was expiring on June 30th. I'm not sure the time frame there, but it was expiring, and there had been no negotiations, no even meeting set up or anything. The state had not approved the state budget, which was due by the end of June 30th. And there was a fourth one. The school districts hadn't approved the budget either. That's right. The state and the school districts hadn't approved the budget. That's right. So those four things were there in the middle of June, and I'm thinking, okay, you know, what do we do here? I had no control over the state appropriations. I had little control over the school districts in terms of at least we were going to start meeting with them, which we did to get some approval there. I did have some control over at least trying to get negotiations started, and I couldn't do much with Bill Shrum. So July came along, and I was doing all kinds of things, and there still were no meetings set up. And I finally called the attorney, Bill Vanderlyn, and I said, Bill, we've got to do something. I said, you know, school's supposed to start here in another month or so, and I need to know, are we going to have school? Are we not going to have school? What are we going to do? Well, he said, you know, nobody does anything till midnight when the contract runs out. And maybe the contract didn't run out till later then, I don't know. And I said, Bill, I said, I can't wait that long. I said, we got a couple thousand students going to come here or whatever. I said, we need to do something. Well, he sent a letter to John Burnett.
Who was the PSC faculty at the time,
yeah. And said, I'm available these days. And John sent it back saying, well, I'm available these days. And these guys knew each other. They both scheduled when their vacations were. They knew all this stuff was going on. And so I finally said, Bill, you got to do something. It was now in the early August, as I recall. So they finally agreed with the teaching, and Bob Bowers was the administration's representative, and I can't remember at the time who was on the faculty negotiating team. I just can't remember. But anyway, they met on a Tuesday night, and they met again on Thursday, and about midnight I got a call from Bob Bowers at home, got me out of bed, and said, if we do another 0.5%, I think we can settle this tonight. Two meetings it took, and I didn't have authority to go over Bob knew what the limit was, and I didn't have any authority, and it's midnight, and the president of the board's not available. I mean, what do you do? So I said, yes, go ahead, and I took some flack for that a little bit later from the board, but we got a contract agreed to that night, and eventually state appropriations were. However, state appropriations were late because another thing came up. I had instituted a hiring freeze, and there was a hiring freeze and a freeze on capital equipment in late in the year because the state still had not approved a budget. So while eventually it did happen and all these things did fall into place, that was another issue. In early October, these are a couple things, Dan, that I thought of since we first spoke. Before October, in late September, and you may remember, well, I don't know, you weren't here that year. Were you here that year? There was a drought that year. And I remember being called by the paper. This was, again, school was in session, I think. And it was probably late August or so, and it was a very severe drought because there were wells drying up and so on, and they called and wanted to know what we could do. And I said, well, we've tried to, I think we bought some dry kinds of hand things for the shops, and I said, if it really comes to it, I said, we could close for a while, period of time, and send all these hundreds of kids home, get out of here using this Williamsport water supply and close down the school for a while, et cetera. So I remember that happened. And the final thing that happened, October 10th, I was just telling this to Linda Morrison this morning, if she remembered it, we had a major snowstorm. Major. Started like 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and by noon we had a foot of snow. And I had already closed school and sent everybody home. And I was the last one out of the parking lot because I kept listening to the radio, and all of the roads, I lived down in Hughesville, and all the roads were closed. Traffic was tied up, and I thought, how am I going to get home? It took me 5 hours to get home. But I remember that major snowstorm. So there were a lot of things in the first 3, 4, 5 months of school that I had to deal with. And of course, the other thing was that there was an ongoing search that had started, and we were narrowing candidates down and so on. That was always ongoing.
What are your recollections of going to visit the 20 school districts?
We'd been in existence now for a number of years, and there was starting to be some restlessness with the school districts about this is costing us too much money, and they were having their own other budgetary woes. So they were not pleasant, but I remember one specific one with Grant Berry and I went to Canton School District where we walked in, and we were just there if they had any questions on the budget that we could answer, et cetera. And there was a room full of people, and here it turned out it was the Canton girls softball team, and their parents had won the league championship and were eligible to participate in a statewide tournament. And the school board had said no, that they didn't have any money. They'd not budget any money. And so the parents were there to put pressure on the school board to find, and I think they're only talking a few hundred dollars. I mean, how much going to cost at that point to send a few girls on a bus to some game somewhere? And they said no. But they approved our budget, never asked us a question, just it came up on the agenda, and any questions, no, and they approved it. And I said to Grant, I said, I think we need to get out of here. So we did. But it was that kind of thing where we were competing for major dollars from these school districts, and the school districts themselves were, you know, competing with us for their own activities. And so it was in the situation here, I can't speak for the other community colleges and the others. Some of them were sponsored by a county, which means they didn't have to deal with 18 school districts or whatever. They just had to deal with a county. But it was not the easiest thing to do nor the most pleasant thing at that time.
A couple of major undertakings were underway during your time as interim president. One was the completion of the Carl Construction Technology Building. What do you recall about that?
Yes, that was that had been started prior to my assuming the interim presidency, but I remember it was completed right after Dr. Bruder came, and we had a dedication ceremony to Dr. Carl at the time, and he was there, and Bruder was there, and I was there, and a number of dignitaries and so on. That was, the first major new facility on this campus, as I recall. I don't think there was anything new. There might have been some slight modernization done here and there, but that was the first major addition to this campus in maybe forever, I don't know, in a long time anyway. There was also going on the fundraising was the other activity, and the college had, because of the Carl Building and some other buildings that they wanted, they really had developed under Feddersen a pretty good long-range plan in terms of finally addressing the needs of the facilities. They hired an outside firm, a consulting firm, with this fundraising activity. And the short time, the 9 months I was in there, I don't think it went well. I don't think we were paying several thousand dollars a month to this consulting firm. And it was either the firm itself or the representative they assigned us, but it did not go well, except for one thing that I remember, and that was that we got a call one day to go up to Avco Light Cumming, where they gave us $250,000 over 5 years, I believe, to name the machine shop, the Avco machine shop, because they use a lot of machinists from there. And that was a big plus towards, I can't remember what the goal was. It was a couple million dollars or more, maybe. But the experience with the fundraising was not good, and I had suggested at one point that we had a committee of some board members and administrators that we were wasting our money with this firm, but that was, I don't really recall what happened. I think we stuck it out till the end of the contract, but I don't think we got our money's worth.
What did you enjoy most about being interim president?
What did I enjoy most? Well, I guess I had a great time. And, you know, I'd said initially right up front to the board that I was not a candidate, that I'd already exceeded my goal by being a president. My goal was to be a dean, and I'd done that, and I said I'm not interested in being a president. But I will have to admit, as I have to many people later on, as the time went on, it became kind of fun to be number one, to be sitting in that seat and having people respond to you. Simple example. Grant Baer and I were going to lunch one day, and we walked out in front, and there was some trees that were lying out there, and I hit my head on a branch. I said, you know, these trees need to be trimmed. And so when I got back to the office after lunch, I called, I don't remember now who was in charge of maintenance at the time. That afternoon, the trees were trimmed. I mean, you know, how many other people get that kind of a response, you know, when you call them and say, hey, the president said, just go trim the trees. So you trim the trees. But it got to be fun, and I enjoyed it. I mean, I had some great people to work with that can make it fun or can make it really nasty and a terrible experience. But it was a great experience, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. And by the end, I almost said, see, maybe I should have been a candidate, you know. And I had the opportunity. In fact, we were at the last meeting with the board, and they were reviewing the final candidates, and one of the board members spoke up and said, you know, I still think we ought to get Dave to apply. And a couple others nodded their heads and said, yeah, I think we should. He's done a good job. And I said, no. I said, I had my opportunity, and I told you no. And I said, I don't think it would be fair now at this point to throw my hat in the ring. And I said, no, I won't change my mind. And I didn't. But I think it was gratifying that some of them felt, after 9 months, that I had done a good job, and that they were willing to consider me to stay on. So, but I it was a great experience, great experience.
And the board, when Dr. Bruder became president, they gave you some recognition.
I got a very nice plaque from them, complimenting me on my short and brief tenure as the president, and recognizing me for what I had done. I certainly appreciated that.
And what were some of the responsibilities you had before you left in 1982 to become an administrator at Susquehanna Health or Waynesport Hospital at that time?
Well, when Dr. Bruder came, who was hired then as the permanent president, for some reason, didn't want me to go back to being dean of students, and started to look for things that I could do. Well, there were a couple of things that I sort of stayed as his assistant for a few months, doing some things and in a transition type thing. I remember one thing, for example, we decided that with this consulting firm gone, that we needed a local group and local people, and we were going over names, and I mentioned, I said, well, you can't have any kind of fundraising in Williamsport if you don't have Bill Pickenler. And he said, oh, Bill Pickenler's on the board out at, like, I mean, he's not going to do anything here. And I said, well, okay. Well, later on, as you may recall, Bill Pickenler has received awards from here and became active, but it was helping with that kind of thing. Well, then the building trades director was vacant, empty for some reason. I don't remember, somebody left or retired or whatever. And he said, you go over while we're doing that and run the building trades. And at the same time, I came in one day and he said, I'm going to make you a director of institutional research, which I don't, although I worked on my doctorate degree and certainly did some research and had research courses, didn't consider myself a research, I'm a people person, not a research person. But I guess if I wanted to be employed, I said yes. So I, for a number of months, had dual hat of director of the building trades division and director of institutional research, which he gave me some things to do, grant writing and some other stuff. And but I began to recognize that that this was not going to be a fit. There was no job here that Dave Heine was going to be acceptable to in Dr. Bruder's eyes, and probably that he wasn't acceptable to me in my eyes. And I thought at that point we'd made a mistake. But needless to say, I began to look, and I think he was glad I was looking. And he and I didn't see eye to eye on many, many things. And fortunately, a position came up as director of education at Williamsport Hospital, and I was hired out there by Frank Tripoli and left after, I guess I was here about a year and a half under Dr. Bruder.
As you look at the college campus now, what do you think in comparison to when you saw it both as a high school student and initially as a WTI employee?
Well, obviously the major changes. I mean, from the physical facilities, some absolutely tremendous facilities, some of the finest in the state. The enrollment has gone from 1,000 to 6,000. The faculty has some absolutely distinguished academic faculty, and yet they were able to maintain the hands-on trades kind of programs that made this institution what it is. And and I think while Dr. Bruder had his opponents, he did a lot for the physical facilities of this college and the name of the college, and he was able to break away from the school districts and go with Penn State, which was a major accomplishment. And so there's a lot of good things that he did and left his name here on this campus. And certainly many of the changes should be attributed to him.
What opportunities and challenges do you see for the college in the future?
Well, I'm concerned, and I asked this question specifically to the president at a meeting. If you read statistics about high school enrollment, it's going down, down, down. Now, this is a cyclical thing, and it probably will come back up in a few years. But I would be concerned about the enrollment, and the second aspect of the enrollment is the financial health of the college. There's major debt with all of the buildings and facilities that they have. There's a facility under construction or renovation over there now. And I asked her about enrollment, and her response was that their predictions are that enrollment will continue to grow, maybe more slowly than it has in the past, but it will continue to grow. And so they saw no problems. But if I were here, if I were an administrator, those would be my concerns, would be enrollment and the financial health of the institution. I mean, I think they've got the facilities and they've got the campus and this beautiful library building they just built. And so it looks healthy, and I would hope it stays healthy.
As you look back on your long and very distinguished career and your many contributions to the college, said very seriously, both at WTI and WAC, what do you take the greatest satisfaction regarding?
Well, I think my experiences here started my professional career, really. When I talked about that experience with the concert, I mean, I learned so many things under WTI and the community college, and then when I came back with some experiences in hand, it was just a great place, and I had great experiences here. Probably the height of my career in terms of being the interim president, certainly as my professional career, although I went on and did a number of things after that. But I have very, very fond memories of WTI and the community college, and I think it really gave the boost to my professional career, my decision to be a student life person to start with, and so on.
Well, thank you for taking the time to share your recollections and memories and to help us document your contributions and to understand this transition from the Technical Institute to the Community College. You said earlier that you were a people person, and you certainly were always regarded very highly by students, by staff, and by faculty. And so
thank you.
I'm glad we've had this chance.
Thank you. My pleasure.